Appreciate that good song. Appreciate you being here and all the struggles. I didn't plan your trouble today. I want you to know that. However, the sermon is noted for your trouble today. For those of you who came in late, I give you the instructions about those envelopes. I changed the strategy for Dave and Julie. I put them in envelopes. So these note cards are, you're going to fill them out. There's a name on them. Put the date of today on the top of it. And you're going to say something you're thankful for about that person. For instance, if Dave had Julie's, he would say something like, "You're the greatest thing since sliced bread." Something like that. I don't know what, but anyway. So, and then also put a prayer on there that you're praying for them, and then that person, you should remember them all week if you can, and put it down, put you a note, put those cards back in the envelope at the end of the service. I'll be out front. I'll collect those cards. You'll get a new set of cards next week, and we're going to do this all the way through Thanksgiving. One of the things that I think churches fail is we fail to communicate to each other how well, how thankful we are to each other. Honestly, we come in and we leave. We don't have the time, like at work, you're sitting there and you're working with people, or, you know, at a meal, you're talking to people, but when we come to church, we just come and go. And we don't have the time to talk to people and say, "Hey, I appreciate you doing this," or "thankful for this." And I think it's something that we ought to do and definitely practice. And, you know, just because it's Thanksgiving, we should do it all the time, to be thankful. Take your Bibles and turn to Mark chapter 3. We've been looking at this subject matter, the Gospel of Mark. And the biggest take of this series so far that we've looked at is the fact that this is the Gospel of God, literally. In your Bible, you may see the Gospel according to Mark, or the Gospel of Mark, but it's literally the Gospel of God written by the pen of Mark, as he is describing in the book of Mark, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, and the Son of Man, the gift of mankind. He is outlining, if you would, the works of Christ as he is a servant to the people. And you're going to see that in the message today a little bit. And from Mark chapter 1 to Mark chapter 8, this question comes up often. Who is this guy? What does he think he's doing? Who does he think he is? There is opposition from chapter 1 to chapter 8. Mark only has 16 chapters, so half the book is filled with people trying to oppose Jesus and especially to do away with him. And we are in chapter 3. We already did part of chapter 3 of last week, and it's a continuation of part of chapter 2, the latter part of it. Jesus gave this parable out to those he was teaching. He said, you can't put new wine in old bottles, and you can't sew new material to old material. And the disciples were walking through a cornfield on the Sabbath as Jesus was headed to church. And one of those examples, his disciples took some corn and began to eat the corn. And these opposers said, who do they think they are? It's the Sabbath day. They shouldn't be eating corn on the Sabbath day or plucking corn. Who do you think you are to allow them to do such a thing? And so they walked on to the temple, and when they got into the temple, Jesus walks in, and there's a man there who has a withered hand. It's limp. It's you could say it's paralyzed, has no feeling in it, and so it's just laying there in, on his arm, so to speak. And Jesus walks in, notices him, and when he notices him, he turns to these opposers who was following him, who just questioned him and his disciples about eating corn, and he turned to them and he said, "Is it permissible?" Jesus asking them permission, "Is it okay to do good or evil on the Sabbath? Is it okay for me to heal this man or not?" And the opposers were silent. They didn't say anything. And so we come to this particular verse. "And when he had looked around about on them with anger, being grieved for the hardness of their hearts, he saith unto the man, Stretch forth thine hand. And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored whole as the other." Jesus, there were a couple of times that the Bible talks about that he got angry, and this is one of them. You remember very distinctly, Jesus went into the temple and they were selling and trading. They had a flea market set up at the and on the porch of the church, and Jesus went in with a whip and beat them, and he was mad. But here's the other one. When he turned to these opposers who's been opposing him and questioning him about the corn, and he says, "Is it okay for me to do good or evil on the Sabbath day?" The piercing question was who was doing the evil and who was doing the good. It was convicting because they were actually doing evil, preventing something good to happen. And so when they spoke nothing, when they said absolutely nothing, Jesus got angry or instilled in him a feeling like sadness, brokenness, because these are the ones who are the leaders of the church, the officials of the church, and they're not even saying it's okay for him to heal this guy. And so he was moved with sadness. And so he went ahead and healed the individual. And we found out in that message last week that the Sabbath was intended for the people. God made the Sabbath for you and me. Not for us to put laws and regulations on it to make it so burdensome for us, but he made the Sabbath for you to rest. Even in his Ten Commandments, he said, "Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy." Later he said, "The Sabbath is a day of rest." It's for you. It's not for you to do whatever you want to do. It's for you to enjoy and relax. And then the second thing we learn is that Jesus is the Lord of the Sabbath. And he didn't really need permission to do whatever he needed to do because he was the creator of it. Today we're going to look at verses 6 through 12, adopting the family. Matter of fact, adopting the family will be the theme for the rest of this chapter that we're going to look at, but we're only going to look at verses 6 through 12. I want us to first of all look at the people in this chapter, and beginning in verse number 6, the crowds that were coming to him. The Bible says, "And the Pharisees went forth and straightway took counsel with the Herodians against him, how that they might destroy him. But Jesus withdrew himself with the disciples to the sea," that is the Sea of Galilee, "and a great multitude from Galilee followed him from Judea." Now, I don't know what you would think for just a moment. Spare with me. This is going to go pretty quick. Okay, but then we're going to slow up. So the crowds of people, who would they be? Who would be the ones that would be following Jesus? And it names them that they came from all over the place in Judea. But who were they? If you remember, Jesus, by way back when, said that those that need healing are the ones that are sick. The only ones that need Jesus to be saved are those that are lost. And here we find that in this midst of crowds, and it may be one of you today, those that are in the crowd are those that need a special healer. These people were sick. They were hurt. They had diseases. They had demons. and they were coming to Jesus because they heard about him healing. Number one, they heard about him standing up against these scribes and Pharisees in the church, and then they heard about this healing. He had done other healings up to this point, but this one drew their attention because it was in church and it spread like wildfire. And so now everybody has heard it, and so they're coming out of the woodworks, coming to Jesus to be healed. They have problems in their life, and so they need a touch. And only those people that really know that they are sick and in need of something are going to come after it. You don't go to the doctor when you're well. You go to the doctor when you're sick, and some people fight over going to the doctor when you're... And sometimes when you go to the doctor, you have to tell the doctor, this is what's wrong with me. Because they don't know what's wrong with you. You have to tell them what's wrong with you. And then they charge you $500 for you to tell them what's wrong with you. But anyway, in order for you to be healed, you got to go see the guy that's going to heal you. These crowds were in need of a shepherd. They were lost. They were wandering around. The disciples needed some leading and guiding and teaching, especially the ones that he has called up to this point. So they were in need of a shepherd. They were also in need of a Savior. You don't know that you need a Savior until you realize that you're lost. And so in this crowd are these people. They're in need of Jesus, and so they're coming. But then there's another group within this crowd, and that is those that are what I call snoopy, snooty, and spectators. There are some people that come to church and follow Jesus because they're nosy. They just follow in the crowd. They want to go there because somebody else is there. There are some people there that are snooty. They look down their nose at people. They don't treat people the same way. They think certain people's got certain privileges, and so they find something to complain about. And so there were those people in the crowd as well. And then there are those that are just spectators. They just come and sit and enjoy, and they don't get involved, and they don't do anything, and so they're just hanging out. And immediately, between these two groups of people in the crowd, we have a division. There's two different kinds of people, classes of people. But let me bring out another class of people. These are the religious people. I call them the cowards, the plotters, the deceivers, the ones that was actually after Jesus and wanting to destroy him. So in the crowd, you have people that need him. In the crowd, you have people that don't carry the way. And then you have these plotters or people who are cowards to really stand up and say who they were. They were out to kill Jesus and destroy him. And who are they? The Bible describes them right here. There's one group called the scribes. The scribes are in the early couple of chapters of Mark. The scribes were simply exactly what they were. They were clerks. And their responsibility was to take the law. Listen, this is not boring stuff. This is important stuff for you to understand about the end of the message, so pay attention. So the scribes were to take the law of Moses, look at it as events were taking place in history, because all kinds of situations would come up in the church and in the community, and now they're under the Roman Empire rule and government, and the Roman Empire was telling them they had to do certain things. So the scribes were studying the law and saying what they should and shouldn't do. And they would decipher the law as the intent of what Moses wrote and what God wrote, and they would write out an excerpt concerning a particular law that was in the church. And their responsibility was to teach. They were to hold Bible studies and Sunday school lessons, and they were to teach the people, this is the way we should do it, and this is why we should do it. That was their responsibility. However, it completely changed when Jesus came up on the scene. The Sanhedrin court, which was the supreme court of the church, ruled by the priest of the Jews, they sent the scribes out to be reporters, investigators. They got away from the law of God, interpreting it, studying it, and reading it, and being close to God. They were supposed to be the ones the closest to God because they would decipher and pray over what the scriptures. Now they're going out at the command of the Sanhedrin court to investigate Jesus. The second group of people here we have as the Pharisees, and this group of people fall into two categories. One category is a more stringent, a more conservative group, if you would. They come from two philosophers or teachers in the Jewish history. One was named Shammai, and that was the more conservative one. They loved the law. They wanted to follow the Moses' law as strictly as they could. Matter of fact, the Shammaiites, they did not want to have anything to do with the Roman Empire, and anything that the Roman Empire said or did, they hated. They hated the taxation. They hated tax collectors. They were out to make sure and install the rigid worship service in the temple. And then there was the other group that came from another philosopher and teacher in the Jewish church. And they were more relaxed. They were more accommodating. They liked for people to come to their church. They welcomed them in who they were. They liked the Gentiles. They tolerated them. The other group did not like the Gentiles. They didn't want the gospel to go to the Gentiles at all. They despised them. And eventually, these two groups of people, the Pharisees in the church, fought against each other, debated greatly against each other. The only thing that was going good for those two groups of people within the Pharisees was that they believed in the resurrection of life after death. They agreed with that. But all other aspects of the law, one was really loving and accepting, the other one was very strict and stringent, and you had to wear a certain thing. If you didn't wear a certain thing, you were not welcome. So there was a great divide in the worship service, division in the family. Has anybody here ever had a division in your family? Huh? Come on, y'all in church, I'll be honest. Y'all ever had an argument at home? You know, which side of the toilet paper is supposed to go on? Is it up or down? How about the toilet lid? Is it supposed to be down or up? How about where your shoes are supposed to be? At the door or inside at the kitchen table? I'm not going to get anybody upset this morning, but in the church there was a division among these people. And the third group, which is mentioned here, is the Herodians, which is very interesting. You could say this is strange bedfellows with the Pharisees. The Pharisees wanted to establish the Jewish government back in place, like the old world. The Herodians wanted the same thing. However, there were two different groups of people. The Pharisees wanted to establish the throne of David. The Herodians, like their name, followed Herod the Great. They were more a political religious group. They were gung-ho for the Roman Empire while yet being a Jew. Most of the Herodians were Edomites. And what's so important about that is what I'm about to show you in a map. But the Herodians were basically the Edomites, and the Edomites come from the lineage and the tree of Esau. And you remember the split between Jacob and Esau? They were brothers and they didn't like each other. One sold their birthright and they had issues. So I'm going to review with you just a moment. The crowd that Jesus is teaching are those that want Him and need Him, don't care about Him either way, trying to be speculative of what He was saying, and then those that were trying to kill Him. So how would you like to deal with that crowd? Sounds like a political rally somewhere, I don't know where. But then there's this third group of people, and this group of people were the called. As these people came to Jesus, and as He saw their needs, and He healed some, and He answered the questions of others, and He knew the devil was in the midst of them, there were some that Jesus actually called to be his disciples. He saw something in them and he said, man, these are good people and I want to make them a part of my family. So how do you deal with a hostile crowd of people or an indifferent crowd of people, and then you have your special family crowd of people? How do you treat them? Do you treat one different than the other? I mean, let me ask you, how would you treat your family here? Who would you stand up for and defend greater than someone else? Is there someone here that would be more apt to, you would take a bullet for than the other? Jesus had to deal with this group of people, this crowd, and understanding that God is love. And his whole desire was to help these people. And how would he do it? Very quickly, I'm going to give you to this, the places. We talked about the people, now the places. The map on your left is Israel. The map on your right is more about where he is. He's in Capernaum at the Sea of Galilee. And this is Aduma, which is Edom. The Edomites are there. And this is where all the people came from. The furthest distance in this map that people came was about 150 miles to go see Jesus. Some were 40, some were 30. Some came from Tyre and Sidon way up north, and some came way down south in the Edomites. Some came on the other side of the Jordan River. Somehow they had to get across the Jordan River, and the Jordan River was very rapids. It was very hard to cross. But these people were desperate to get to Jesus. And it's recorded that these people were coming to see Jesus to find out what's going on, what's happening. And if you'll note in the next verses, verse 8, and from Jerusalem and from Aduma, and from the Beyond Jordan and from Tyre and Sidon, a great multitude, not just a few people, not just 100 people, not just 10, but a great multitude of people, when they had heard what great things he did, came unto him, and he spake to his disciples that a small ship would wait on him because of the multitude, lest they be thrown. In other words, he told his disciples, put a ship out in the ocean or in the Sea of Galilee, and I will retreat there so they don't pull me under, drag me, kill me. So, verse number 10 says, for he had healed many insomuch that they pressed upon him for to touch him, as many as had plagues and unclean spirits, and they saw him, fell down before him, and they cried, thou art the Son of God. The first time they met Jesus, they said, you are the Son of God. Now this is the conclusion of the message. I want you to listen to me very carefully. This is the big picture, the perception of what is happening. You may think, what in the world is going on? And I'm going to give you a lesson in life. You ready? This will change your life. Not because I said it, if you will just understand it. Your perspective on life, the way you see it right now, you have come to a conclusion about life in general by what has happened to you in the past. Somebody over here has done something, said something, something has happened, the environment of your past, the smoke cloud, the clouds, you either see a glass half full or half empty, based upon your past. You either today are living in the fact that all things bad are going to happen to you because all things bad happened to you in the past. There's so many things that happen to you and you can feel it and sense it and you say, well, that's just my life. That's just the way it is. And so here you are in the present, and you think there's no, you either see that there's clouds out there, or you think there's no clouds. You either think that it's a bad day or it's a good day based upon your perception of what happened in the past. How you woke up this morning and you saw the day, you looked at it and you said, well, I'm looking at this day based upon what's happened in the past, and you're either going to have a good attitude about the day or you're going to have a bad attitude about the day, and it all has to do with the past. And back there in the past, you cannot change it. You cannot alter it. You cannot go back and say, reverse the time. You can't go back there and say, you can say it, I wish I did something different, but you can't go back there and do something different. You're living in the present, but your whole presence of today and your perception of who you are and what you are and what you're going to do is based on your experience of the past. That's how you perceive today. But also within, Bob, that you see a little light at the end of the tunnel in the future. You see that there's hope. You see that possibly you can change your life and the past and the cloud and your bad mistakes if you do keep going and you hit that light somewhere, the end of the tunnel, whatever it may be. You reach the goal at gold at the end of the rainbow. If you could just get that, if you could just win the lottery, if you could just stumble upon a pile of gold, it would change your life forever. And so you're hoping in the future that it would change your present. So you're in this world of battlement between your past and your future. And your perception of what you are today, here and now, is based on those two things that you think in your mind that life is. So, I'm going to give you some things in closing. And when I say closing, I don't mean the next 2 minutes, okay? So don't get mad at me. Don't throw tomatoes at me if I'm not throwing 2 minutes. The first thing to understand about this perception is that there's two pockets that falls in. One is there is a natural perspective of life. And by that I mean things are happening naturally. Every single person in this room has a perspective on something. Amen? And you may be tired of hearing the opinions of a lot of the people by now, depending on the debate and what, you know, what's going on in the world. But there is a natural perspective that you have. It is something that God created you with. Every single person in this room has a different perspective about life. And I'll give you an example. If we were to go outside and look up the star or the sky and see a cloud, you might say, hey, there's a dog. And someone else would say, no, that's a dragon. And somebody else would say, no, that's a cat. And somebody else may say, no, it's a turtle. And then as the cloud dissipates, you begin to come up. Have you ever done that? Don't look at me like I'm dumb. You've done it. I know you have. How about this? This is more practical. You go to a restaurant, you sit down to the table, a waiter or waitress gives you a menu, hands you a menu, and you're there with your family, and there's five or six people there, or two or three. Maybe it's just a lovely romantic dinner, just you and your partner. Menu comes. You look at the menu, and the question comes out, what do you see that's good? What are you going to order? Do you order the same thing as your partner? Hello. Y'all are in church again? No, you don't. You know why you don't? You have a different perspective on what is good food. There are some people, when they go to a restaurant, they sit down and they look at the menu and they say, I know exactly what I want. I hate those people, by the way, because they order the same thing. A burger with no onion, no tomato, no ketchup, no mustard, just a burger. They know what they're going to order. Same thing. It's a special order. Then there are people who look at the waiter and the waitress and say, what do you recommend? What do you think is the best thing on the menu? And they're a little adventurous, and they'll say, they may say whatever, tongue of a cow. And so you say, oh, I'm going to eat that. That sounds good. And so you try it. And then there are some people who go into a restaurant and order food. Y'all understand what I'm about and what I'm saying, where I'm going? And some of you go to a restaurant and you look and you say, well, I'm going to try something different. I've tried this other stuff, and I'm going to go out on a limb and I'm going to eat octopus and something. One thing that my wife and I did when we went to California, I did that, by the way. I'm talking to myself. We went to a Mexican restaurant and they had cactus, fried cactus. Whew. How many has ever had fried cactus? How many want fried cactus? I will tell you, it's like green beans. I'm serious. It's good stuff. It was really good food. Either that or they cooked it good. Then there are some people who looked at that menu and they will say, based on my personal experience, because they've been to that restaurant before, they'll say, this is the best meal to get. They may or may not order it, but they'll tell you instructions, this is the best food. I mean, you go to a pizza place and you order a hamburger. Did y'all catch that? You go to a pizza place and order a hamburger? No. You go to a fish restaurant and you order a pizza? No, you don't do that either. You go to a Chinese restaurant and you order Mexican food? No, you don't do that either. So, but the person can give you their best experience. I'm going to give you some real live experiences here to the moment. This is a picture of a galaxy and the universe through the Hubble telescope. The Hubble telescope is one of the most powerful telescopes that we have in the world. And if I were to ask you, what do you see there? What would you say? Now I'm not going to ask you what your opinion is, what it may be, but I'm going to tell you what the actual name of this is in just a few minutes. But what do you see there? So it's like a bunch of snakes hugging each other. I don't know. But this is what they say it is. It's called the Pillars of Creation. Technically, Eagles Nebula, Pillars of Creation. On the right, you'll see another picture. What do you see? You want to describe it? A big wave, a monster with big ears, dragon, okay? It is called the Horsehead of Nebula. More specifically, they've named it Barnard 33. So you can see in natural reaction in the world, we have a natural division. You see something different, then I see it. I like peanut butter and jelly. I'll eat peanut butter and jelly all the time. I had a peanut butter and jelly last night. My two dogs have a different perspective of peanut butter and jelly sandwich. One dog ate it. The other one takes its nose and scoots it across the floor until they almost try to bury it because they don't like it. So I don't give it to that person anymore, that dog anymore. I give it to just the one and say, nah, you get it. We do that in our life. We have a natural division. But then there's another part of perspective of life, and that is the supernatural things that are happening. Some people refer to it as karma, good luck or bad luck, Murphy's Law. Supernatural things are things that are done and you have no control over it. You didn't create it, you made it, you didn't make it. There's nothing that you could have done to make it happen. It's just supernatural how things happen. Like going down the highway. Maybe you were late leaving for work or wherever you're going, and 2 minutes down the highway there's a massive accident and somebody's killed, but you're not because you were delayed. I would call that a kind of supernatural perspective on life. And one thing for sure, because we're studying the book of Mark, the happenings that are taking place are supernatural. It's the handiwork of God that's what happened. Even in the midst of opposition coming to Jesus, there's still supernatural happenings because they're at the hand of God. He's the director of this movie, and He is also the director of your life. He controls your breathing, whether you're breathing now or not. Going back to the crowds, this is what always has just, it hasn't boggled my mind as much as it's amazing to me in this crowd. Same person, Jesus, same words, same healing, same things going on, but this crowd, some followed Him, some believed Him, some chose to be a disciple, some rejected Him totally, and others hated Him to destroy Him. My question to you today is, which one are you? Are you coming to Him because you need Him? Are you coming to Him to be a spectator? Are you committed your life to Him, to follow Him all the days of your life? You may not even know much about Jesus or this religious thing, and have you committed to learn something about it? This is the amazing thing to me about life. God created man for woman and woman for man, and they have two completely opposite perspectives in life. So how can two people, one having pink eyeglasses and another one blue eyeglasses, one seeing the toilet paper come over and the other one under, one liking the toilet seat up and the other one liking it down, can fall in love, create a family, and have unity and peace, joy and happiness? How is that possible? How is it possible that God can bring so many various people into a house called the worship place of God and bring it together so that we all are in unison in the same mind, in the same spirit? How in the world is it that there are millions of graduates across the United States and across the world, and they're going to make a decision in their life about where they're going to go, be it college, be it a job, be it military? How in the world do they make that decision? How can they make a decision on something they don't even know and it be the right decision? I don't know if you've gone to a rescue shelter where you adopt a pet. How do you choose the right pet to pick? You just randomly go over there and say, oh, take this one. Or is there some thought process involved? Is there an inspiration? Is there a bonding of the spirits, so to speak? How does that happen? Does it happen naturally, or is it a supernatural thing? I mean, how does two people from two different cultures, two different places in the world, two different perspectives on life, one liking peanut butter and jelly, the other one liking steak, and they're all of a sudden they meet each other, and in one moment they fall in love, get married, and have a wonderful family? Is that natural or supernatural? Let me show you one more. I don't know what you would say that is. I have my perspective on what that is, and you might have your perspective. I will tell you something about this little galaxy. You may know something about space and time and matter, but I'll give you something. Light travels, follow me, light travels 186,000 miles per second. That's faster than you can see, 186,000 miles per second. In a given year, light travels approximately 5.8 trillion miles. This galaxy, it is a galaxy, by the way, from end to end, from side to side, from west to east or north to south, however how you want to measure it, is about 50,000 light years apart. And the distance of this galaxy to us and Earth is 28 million light years away. Now you think about that. The Hubble telescope found this galaxy, and it's out there. And you wonder, what is it? How in the world did it get created? What happened? So the description of this, and you'll see the simulants of why they call it this. It's called the Sombrero Galaxy. Does it look like a little sombrero, maybe, to you? So here's some facts. This is it. Closing. Give me two minutes. One thing for sure you can determine by what we just read, what we talked about. A, there is a crowd that is following Jesus. Not only are they following him, they're following him in various forms. Secondly, there's a plot to destroy him. Thirdly, there is a group that he chooses as disciples. And fourthly, there is a record written down where we have the events, places, and people and the plot recorded. These are the facts that are there. What is your perspective of that? What do you see in this? Is it fantasy, fiction, fable? Is it just something you do? Is religion something that you just do because you were grown? As a natural perspective, there is an acceptance of Jesus Christ and there is a rejection of him. In the natural perspective of what they're seeing, they see this crowd, they see this man, they see the withered hand healed. So naturally, there's the division. Some have accepted it, some have rejected it. However, there is something that is in common with all people. And it's common with everybody here. Whether you believe, accept Jesus, whether you follow him, whether you're a disciple, whether you're a spectator, whether you're just hanging out at church because somebody else came, this fact is true, naturally speaking. All of us need something greater than ourselves to save us and help us. All the books that are written, you can read one author and he'll tell you to do one thing. Another author, he'll tell you to do it. You can go to a doctor and a doctor will say, you take this medicine. And go to another doctor, he says, take this medicine. You go to another doctor, you take this medicine. You go to another doctor and he says, you got to have surgery on this. No, you got to have physical therapy. No, you got to do this. You go to any psychologist, any sociologist, a professor in college, and they'll tell you about science. They'll tell you how it came about, and they'll have this opinion and this opinion and this opinion. You go to the politicians, and they'll say, this is what you need to do the economy. This is what we need to do in defense. This is what we need to do in our Constitution. Everybody's got an opinion. But none of them have the solution. Naturally speaking, there is only one solution. One person who came naturally to this earth in a physical form body that you have to make a decision on, what do you believe about him? Then there is the supernatural perspective. That's the natural. What are you going to do with Jesus? He came, he lived, he died. He rose again, he's coming back. That's the record. People testified of it. So the second thing is the supernatural perspective. Every single one of us have something supernaturally that happens to us that is beyond amazing. and you probably don't even think about it. And that is the fact that every morning when you wake up, you breathe. Where does that come from? Did you get a pair of jumper cables during the night and shock you? How does your body know you need oxygen when you need it? One of the amazing things that you have going on for your life is that you're able to breathe. I don't know if you've ever been around a person who is starving for air. Jesus did that on the cross, where he lifted himself up. You find them in the hospital, starving for breath. And one of the greatest privileges that you have in your life is that you have the breath of life. Where did that come from? When you were first born, they cut the umbilical cord. They slapped you on the rump, and you began to cry. Some babies struggle to breathe because of all the phlegm that is down their throat. And the nurses have to drag it out, get it out of there. The baby knows amazing that that phlegm is in the baby's system. But immediately when that child gets into the atmosphere that we're living in, it begins to choke. Why? It needs to breathe. God is the sole possessor of your life. He's the one that takes your life, and he's the one that allows you to live by his grace. Life is but a vapor. You're here today and gone tomorrow. The Bible describes it as grass growing up, and it is cut down and withereth. Before you know it, your life is gone. You ought to be thankful for the breath you have today. Some people look at it and say, well, it's just part of nature. Or it's because I'm healthy and strong. All of those things are going to fade away. But there is a director of your life, the movie of your life. And whatever perspective you have on him, past, present, or future, you should honestly give him thanks for everything that has happened to you in your life. You see, he came looking for you. You didn't go looking for him. The second thing is, he loves you with an everlasting, everlasting love. And the third thing is, he has left you a magnificent choice. And that choice is the fact that you can choose to accept him or reject him, follow him, give him your life. And my question is, what is your perspective? He has given all the tools necessary for you to make that decision. He's left a record. He's not only left a record, he's left a stamp in a lot of people's lives so that they in turn can love you and care for you and bless you and help you along the way because they have a kind spirit, the Spirit of Christ. Our world is in a mess. And it's in a mess because of this perspective thing. But can I say something very honest, down to earth? You can desire the things of this world, which will give you no happiness. You can look at the things that are happening to you and be cynical or negative or complaining. Or you can go through life and determine and decide and choose, because it's your choice, I'm going to be happy. I'm going to love somebody. I'm going to care for them because I am loved. Let's all stand. Heads bowed and eyes closed. And I want you to just listen to the song and the words. And if God has spoken to your heart today, I want you to listen. Everything this world needs is right here.
In this very room, there's quite enough love for one like me. And in this very room,
look up and let's sing this together, this last. There's no competition here. We got it all. Very room, there's quite enough love. He's here right now. And there's enough love and joy and power to solve any problem you got in your life, as well as the world. We just have to give it out. Amen. You agree with me? I hope you have a good week this week. This is July the 4th. We didn't sing a nair July 4th song, but that's okay. We do know a Jesus who needs to take care of the world, right? And I'm glad you're here. If you didn't meet my daughter, she's here. You know my horrible daughter-in-law, but her family, despite of her being so horrible, her family is pretty good over here. So if you want to meet them, and we're glad that they were here today. I'm going to ask Dave if he, don't forget those little cards, give them to me on the way out. And Dave dismisses in a word of prayer.